Good afternoon. Welcome to the Welling Lectureship. When a pompous presenter says he needs no introduction, that hyperbole is rarely true. By now, however, Abba Eban has become a friendly face and an unmistakable voice at the George Washington University. He joined us in 1993-94 as the first holder of the J.B. and Morris C. Shapiro Professorship in International Affairs, during which his acumen and his wit helped spellbound the auditors of several lectures like this one, and a sparkling, wide-ranging dialogue with Walter Cronkite, as well as classrooms full of students, some budding diplomats of the Elliott School. His year-long residency was so successful that President Trachtenberg invited him to become the first appointee to a James Clark Welling Professorship, a new chair named for a 19th century president of GW that signals our regard by asking visitors to return at least once a year for 4 years. Not least, last May 14th, Ambassador Eban became our alumnus, awarded an honorary doctorate of humanities as recognition of our respect and affection. But that is all parochial, and Abba Eban is the least parochial man imaginable. All the world knows that he has been the most stunning diplomat of our half century, present at the creation of the State of Israel and its ambassador to the United States and the United Nations from 1948 to 1959. Everyone alive in those and subsequent perilous times for Israel can summon the memory of his calm, reasoned cadences with commitment and courage and astonishing eloquence, standing alone in the UN well to defend the existence of the world's newest and most imperiled nation. As foreign minister from 1966 to 1974, he demonstrated his mettle in policy and negotiations as well as advocacy. Abba Eban is a unique Israeli as well. Born in Cape Town, South Africa, graduated from Cambridge with a triple first, and veteran of World War II. He is scholar as well as statesman, expert among other things in Arabic literature. His 8 books span his many worlds. He has served as president of the Weizmann Institute of Science in Israel and member of the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton. He is gracious and cosmopolitan in his every gesture, truly a citizen of the world. This Welling lecture was planned before we knew what conditions in the Middle East would be like today. It makes it all the more poignant for us to be here today at a time when his wisdom has never been more needed. Ambassador Eban will speak to us this afternoon on old divisions and the new Israel, change in Israeli society.
I'm very grateful to you, Professor Salomon, for the warmth and sincerity of your welcome. I must tell you that I'm deeply moved to find that your opinion about me is almost precisely identical with my own opinion about myself. Chairman's introductions are a unique experience in political literature. The object is to reconcile courtesy with truth, and if possible with some slight exaggeration on the side of courtesy, and this you have most elegantly accomplished today. I certainly emerge in much better heart and spirit than after many occasions on which I was presented to audiences in the United States, notably the occasion when in New York the chairman was the president of one of that country's, your country's great oil companies. He was a man of few words, which were, however, more than adequate to cover the entire range of his thoughts. And he presented me to the audience in the following words: Abba Eban is well known throughout the entire civilized world and also here in New York. It's a moving experience to come back to George Washington University. I certainly hope and pray that the weather will permit you next time to have your commencement exercise in the duly appointed season. And it is that hope that accompanies me as I try to involve you now in a discussion of Israel's divided society and yet its united destiny, which figures in the title that I've been asked to address. I'd like to begin by plunging straight into the affairs of which preoccupy mankind in the present time, and with your permission I will ask myself some questions. The first question: was it really rational for the Israeli leaders in 1993 to proclaim and inaugurate a program for peace? Should Israel renounce any effort to bring that to fruition in the light of the desperate situations which have intervened since then? Can terrorism realistically be expected ever to cease? And is the current international initiative now taking place leading to the conclave between 30 countries for the purpose of outlawing and internationally rebuking terrorism? Is that a positive development? I should like to explain that the reason why I have the habit of asking myself questions, it is because it's the only certain method of obtaining intelligent answers. And let me therefore begin. Was it rational, reasonable, in 1993, on that unforgettable day when I was on the White House lawn, preparatory to delivering a lecture to the assembled audience, was it rational to believe and to state and to proclaim that a reconciliation had taken place between the Israeli nation and the neighboring people, the Palestinian people? I believe it was not only rational, but it was in a sense inevitable. And to understand that conviction, it's necessary to comprehend that many currents of history had to converge in order to make the peace process feasible. Many of these events lay outside the range of Israeli judgment and decision. Together they created what I believe was an overwhelming case for taking the State of Israel on a new course, both of policy and of action. Undoubtedly, the major element which made the peace process feasible, and in fact inevitable, was the downfall of the Soviet system. All of a sudden, almost overnight, the vast weight and bulk of the Soviet Union and of Eastern Europe was transferred from the negative scale to the positive scale of the international balance. No longer the Soviet Union as the spoiler, as the saboteur of peace. No longer the Soviet Union organizing and financing the campaign of Arab hostility against Israel. No longer the Soviet Union closing Israeli access to international agencies. No longer the Soviet Union as the generating power behind the far-flung campaign of defamation which attended Israel in its onward journey. It's impossible to exaggerate the effect of the Soviet collapse on Israel's destiny from that time onward. Today, the Soviet Union is not playing that saboteur role. The Soviet Union is today, theoretically at least, the partner of the United States in the sponsorship of the peace process. I must point out that the presence of the Soviet foreign minister on these celebratory occasions had a certain parody effect, because in fact the Soviet Union has removed itself, and removed itself with our blessing and without any nostalgic longings, from the center of the Middle Eastern discourse. But there were other elements which converged at that time to make it rational for people to believe that the Middle East was on the threshold of a new epoch. Not only was the Soviet Union rapidly changing its policies and its posture towards Israel, but events were moving also in the Arab world in a similar sense. Pragmatism had suddenly become one of the major elements in the approach of the Arab world to Israel. It was not in any sense a matter of virtue or conscience. I think we can willingly liberate our neighbors from any such accusation. It was a fact that men and nations often behave wisely once they have exhausted all the other alternatives. And the Arab world had exhausted all the other alternatives. It had tried everything. It had tried war, it had tried boycotts, it had tried ceasefires, it had tried armistices, it had tried the organization of international condemnations, it had tried five power talks, four power talks, three power talks. It had tried to involve the United States and the Soviet Union and the whole of the European community in a condemnatory and defamatory attitude towards the State of Israel. It had also tried a national rebellion, the Intifada, which had certainly straightened the backs of many young Palestinians, but which had dissolved into a total vacuum with no lasting or permanent effects. And having tried everything, it then went to the alternative of examining its own situation and reaching a different appraisal from that which had governed the virulence of its hostility until that time. And these currents of opinion in favor of a realistic approach, not to us but to their own condition, began to predominate. It had its effects in Syria. We must remember that Syria has never made war against Israel, except on conditions which no longer exist. The first condition was that Egypt should be making war against Israel at the same time. Say what you like about Hafez al-Assad, he is a realist. He understands the valor of which discretion is the better part. He had tried war against Israel without any feasible result. He knew that in his diminished status as a virtually third world country, unable to finance the electric light in Damascus, certainly unable to approach strategic equality with Israel, he had few courses except to adjust himself to a totally new reality. In Jordan, the impulses for peace were even deeper. I cannot forget that shortly after the Six-Day War, the Israeli government of that time appointed me to begin a negotiation, or at least a dialogue, with the Jordanian leaders. We met in what was fondly but rather unrealistically believed to be conditions of secrecy. The procedure was eccentric. The king in London, as he very often was, would tell his Scotland Yard accompanier that he didn't feel well, he must see a doctor at once. It appears to be a law of history that every Arab king has a Jewish doctor. And to that address he would repair. I would have been there for 1 hour. We would converse for 2 hours.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the Welling Lectureship. When a pompous presenter says he needs no introduction, that hyperbole is rarely true. By now, however, Abba Eban has become a friendly face and an unmistakable voice at the George Washington University. He joined us in 1993-94 as the first holder of the J.B. and Morris C. Shapiro Professorship in International Affairs, during which his acumen and his wit held spellbound the auditors of several lectures like this one, and a sparkling, wide-ranging dialogue with Walter Cronkite, as well as classrooms full of students, some budding diplomats of the Elliott School. His year-long residency was so successful that President Trachtenberg invited him to become the first appointee to a James Clark Welling Professorship, a new chair named for a 19th century president of GW that signals our regard by asking visitors to return at least once a year for 4 years. Not least, last May 14th, Ambassador Eban became our alumnus, awarded an honorary doctorate of humanities as recognition of our respect and affection. But that is all parochial, and Abba Eban is the least parochial man imaginable. All the world knows that he has been the most stunning diplomat of our half century, present at the creation of the State of Israel and its ambassador to the United States and the United Nations from 1948 to 1959. Everyone alive in those and subsequent perilous times for Israel can summon the memory of his calm, reasoned cadences with commitment and courage and astonishing eloquence, standing alone in the UN well to defend the existence of the world's newest and most imperiled nation. As foreign minister from 1966 to 1974, he demonstrated his mettle in policy and negotiations as well as advocacy. Abba Eban is a unique Israeli as well. Born in Cape Town, South Africa, graduated from Cambridge with a triple first and veteran of World War II, he is scholar as well as statesman, expert among other things in Arabic literature. His 8 books span his many worlds. He has served as president of the Weizmann Institute of Science in Israel and member of the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton. He is gracious and cosmopolitan in his every gesture, truly a citizen of the world. This Welling lecture was planned before we knew what conditions in the Middle East would be like today. It makes it all the more poignant for us to be here today at a time when his wisdom has never been more needed. Ambassador Eban will speak to us this afternoon on old divisions and the new Israel, change in Israeli society.
I'm very grateful to you, Professor Salomon, for the warmth and sincerity of your welcome. I must tell you that I'm deeply moved to find that your opinion about me is almost precisely identical with my own opinion about myself. Chairman's introductions are a unique experience in political literature. The object is to reconcile courtesy with truth, and if possible with some slight exaggeration on the side of courtesy, and this you have most elegantly accomplished today. I certainly emerge in much better heart and spirit than after many occasions on which I was presented to audiences in the United States, notably the occasion when in New York the chairman was the president of one of that country's, your country's great oil companies. He was a man of few words, which were, however, more than adequate to cover the entire range of his thoughts. He presented me to the audience in the following words: Abba Ibn is well known throughout the entire civilized world, and also here in New York. It's a moving experience to come back to George Washington University. I certainly hope and pray that the weather will permit you next time to have your commencement exercise in the duly appointed season. And it is that hope that accompanies me as I try to involve you now in a discussion of Israel's divided society and yet its united destiny, which figures in the title that I've been asked to address. I'd like to begin by plunging straight into the affairs of which preoccupy mankind in the present time. And with your permission, I will ask myself some questions. The first question: was it really rational for the Israeli leaders in 1993 to proclaim and inaugurate a program for peace? Should Israel renounce any effort to bring that to fruition in the light of the desperate situations which have intervened since then? Can terrorism realistically be expected ever to cease? And is the current international initiative now taking place leading to the conclave between 30 countries for the purpose of outlawing and internationally rebuking terrorism? Is that a positive development? I should like to explain that the reason why I have the habit of asking myself questions, it is because it's the only certain method of obtaining intelligent answers. And let me therefore begin. Was it rational, reasonable, in 1993, on that unforgettable day when I was on the White House lawn, preparatory to delivering a lecture to the assembled audience, was it rational to believe and to state and to proclaim that a reconciliation had taken place between the Israeli nation and the neighboring people, the Palestinian people? I believe it was not only rational, but it was, in a sense, inevitable. And to understand that conviction, it's necessary to comprehend that many currents of history had to converge in order to make the peace process feasible. Many of these events lay outside the range of Israeli judgment and decision. Together they created what I believe was an overwhelming case for taking the State of Israel on a new course, both of policy and of action. Undoubtedly, the major element which made the peace process feasible, and in fact inevitable, was the downfall of the Soviet system. All of a sudden, almost overnight, the vast weight and bulk of the Soviet Union and of Eastern Europe was transferred from the negative scale to the positive scale of the international balance. No longer the Soviet Union as the spoiler, as the saboteur of peace. No longer the Soviet Union organizing and financing the campaign of Arab hostility against Israel. No longer the Soviet Union closing Israeli access to international agencies. No longer the Soviet Union as the generating power behind the far-flung campaign of defamation which attended Israel in its onward journey. it's impossible to exaggerate the effect of the Soviet collapse on Israel's destiny from that time onward. Today, the Soviet Union is not playing that saboteur role. The Soviet Union is today, theoretically at least, the partner of the United States in the sponsorship of the peace process. I must point out that the presence of the Soviet foreign minister on these celebratory occasions had a certain parody effect, because in fact the Soviet Union has removed itself, and removed itself with our blessing and without any nostalgic longings, from the center of the Middle Eastern discourse. But there were other elements which converged at that time to make it rational for people to believe that the Middle East was on the threshold of a new epoch. Not only was the Soviet Union rapidly changing its policies and its posture towards Israel, but events were moving also in the Arab world in a similar sense. Pragmatism had suddenly become one of the major elements in the approach of the Arab world to Israel. It was not in any sense a matter of virtue or conscience. I think we can willingly liberate our neighbors from any such accusation. It was a fact that men and nations often behave wisely once they have exhausted all the other alternatives. And the Arab world had exhausted all the other alternatives. It had tried everything. It had tried war, it had tried boycotts, it had tried ceasefires, it had tried armistices, it had tried the organization of international condemnations, it had tried five power talks, four power talks, three power talks. It had tried to involve the United States and the Soviet Union and the whole of the European community in a condemnatory and defamatory attitude towards the State of Israel. It had also tried a national rebellion, the Intifada, which had certainly straightened the backs of many young Palestinians, but which had dissolved into a total vacuum with no lasting or permanent effects. And having tried everything, it then went to the alternative of examining its own situation and reaching a different appraisal from that which had governed the virulence of its hostility until that time. And these currents of opinion in favor of a realistic approach, not to us but to their own condition, began to predominate. It had its effects in Syria. We must remember that Syria has never made war against Israel, except on conditions which no longer exist. The first condition was that Egypt should be making war against Israel at the same time. Say what you like about Hafez al-Assad, he is a realist. He understands the valor of which discretion is the better part. He had tried war against Israel without any feasible result. He knew that in his diminished status as a virtually third world country, unable to finance the electric light in Damascus, certainly unable to approach strategic equality with Israel, he had few courses except to adjust himself to a totally new reality. In Jordan, the impulses for peace were even deeper. I cannot forget that shortly after the Six-Day War, the Israeli government of that time appointed me to begin a negotiation or at least a dialogue with the Jordanian leaders. We met in what was fondly but rather unrealistically believed to be conditions of secrecy. The procedure was eccentric. The king in London, as he very often was, would tell his Scotland Yard accompanier that he didn't feel well, he must see a doctor at once. It appears to be a law of history that every Arab king has a Jewish doctor. And to that address he would repair. I would have been there for 1 hour. We would converse for 2 hours, after which he would depart, I would depart an hour later, and we would deceive ourselves into believing that neither our British hosts nor anybody else knew about our encounter. It was in fact widely known throughout the Arab world that these encounters were taking place. But in the Middle East and perhaps in other parts of the international system, whatever is not published is deemed not to exist. I remember, for example, the president of the Shah of Iran, who at a time when Israel's mission in Tehran was the largest of all Israeli missions, apart from that in the United States, was assaulted by the ambassador of the Saudi Arabian government, who said to him in a tone of virtuous rebuke, "You have this Jewish, this Israeli air force coming into airline coming into Tehran." The Shah said, "Nothing of the sort happens." Whereupon the Saudi ambassador said, "Yes, but I've been to the airport and it said El Al, International Airlines, arrivals, departures, above everything else, delays. How can you possibly deny this?" To which the Shah responded, "Your Excellency did not see it." Now, this dichotomy between what is reported and what is said is a very familiar part of the diplomatic enterprise with a special relationship to the Middle East. But the negotiations that we conducted, although they did not lead immediately to a peace agreement, were not without effect. I believe that the foundations of a Jordanian-Israeli understanding were laid in those days. It became evident that less than any other Arab country could Jordan, which had then lost the West Bank, possibly believe in the feasibility of victory over the, what was for Jordan, the embattled power of the state of Israel. And therefore, when the time came for Jordan to adjust itself to the new reality, it was no surprise to anybody that they responded with an ardor and enthusiasm which now characterizes the Jordanian-Israeli Treaty of Peace. The truth is that although Jordan is by no means the major Arab country and has no such pretensions, no such claims, the truth is that there are more opportunities for Jordanian-Israeli regional cooperation than is the case with any other of Israeli neighbors. Is it not ridiculous that there should be two ports, one at Eilat and one at Aqaba, within about 5 miles from each other? Why should there not be a joint port authority, enabling both countries to exploit their access to the countries of East Africa and the prosperous Pacific Rim? Is it not illogical that the Dead Sea should be completely dead, that is to say that Israel should be able to prevent its exploitation by Jordan, and Jordan to prevent its exploitation by Israel? Why not a Dead Sea Authority that would enable both countries to exploit what is still today one of the major concentrations of pharmaceutical raw materials, is it logical that there should not be pilgrimage and movement and tourism in a great wave across the Middle East? Let us suppose that somebody interested in the roots of Western civilization could go from Israel's capital, Jerusalem, across the river to Petra, amidst the relics of the great Nabataean civilization, and from there southward to the pharaonic glories of previous ages. Now, all these things are now realities. There is a Dead Sea Authority. There is a joint point port authority for Israel and Jordan. And the impulses that have led to all of this were apparent during our original dialogue. Iraq had collapsed into the status of a hunted pariah country, no longer able to offer Israel that virulent hostility which it has, which it did before and has since displayed. The Gulf War had created a violent upheaval in the Middle Eastern balance of power. It was a congenial war for the West, in a sense, because it was clearly, in the logistic and legal sense, an act of aggression. Kuwait was a member of the United Nations in good standing. And therefore, the collapse of Iraq had transformed Israel's strategic situation beyond any previous memory. Moreover, the leader of Iraq had the virtue, from the viewpoint of his assailants, of a character so totally disagreeable that it was quite possible for him to furnish the hatred. Without war seems not to be feasible. In fact, a historian wrote about him as follows: if there was any vice from which he was exempt, it is only because nature does not permit perfection, even in evil. And he, as the cynosure and the receptacle of international condemnation, had now passed into a position where he was not able, as a result of international intrusion, to carry out his plans for the creation of large deposits of non-conventional weapons. But above all, the major change was in the Palestinian community itself. There is no reason to be surprised at the mutation that has taken place in the attitude of the PLO. It presented itself long before 1993 as a lost cause, a totally impotent country in any military terms, scattered, dispersed, nothing but the memories, sometimes the valiant memories of its previous ordeals, but nevertheless in no condition whatever to come to terms of encounter and conflict with the State of Israel. And it is then that the Palestinian community divided between those who still wanted to conserve the concepts of hostility, virulence, fundamentalistic thinking about religion, which now characterizes the attitudes of the Hamas movement. And it was then, however, that the central mainstream of the Palestinian organizations took a different course, a course which led them to the memorable handshake and meeting of September 1993. In other words, realism and pragmatism had seized hold of the mainstream of the Palestinian movement. But there were other such movements also across the Arab world. Morocco, Tunisia, some of the Gulf states, Qatar, Oman, shortly Bahrain, Kuwait, had all seen Israel as a market of consequence and as a possible collaborator in the development of the regional resources. In other words, an Arab consensus in favor of recognizing Israel was no longer beyond imagination or feasibility. At the same time, Israel was becoming more and more the kind of military power that was usually associated with the great imperial and continental countries. The United States was the author, and is the author, of Israel's military might. And the word might is not an exaggeration. Israel is deemed by the Arab countries to possess every technological resource for self-preservation, self-defense, and if need be, for reprisal. And the concept of joining Israel in a kind of a regional harmony was no longer beyond the thoughts and the imagination of Arab leaders, including King Hussein himself, his crown prince, Hassan, also King Hassan of Morocco, and many of the heads of the Gulf states. Now, what should Israel have done about all this? Ignore it? Pretend that nothing had happened? Not reach out to meet and to encounter these new currents of Arab realism? Israel, even today, amidst the horrors of suicide bombings, has no reason whatever to regret the path that it took. And that path, although it did not lead yet to a stable relationship with the Palestinians, did certainly revolutionize our position in the world community. Israel now has relations with 148 countries, and not the meager 40 that we knew of before. Israel, instead of being the most isolated country in the Middle East, has become perhaps the least isolated country in the Middle East. The possibilities of a regional order in which trade and commerce and people would flow across the boundaries has not been achieved, but it has never become unfeasible. Realistic people could believe in it. But what's fertilized all of these currents of policy and action? Was the change in Israel. When in June 1993, the Israeli electorate intervened to establish a government based on the concepts of originality, innovation, and regional harmony. Now, none of the other currents of opinion and thought to which I've given expression could have happened without that change. If the Israeli position had continued to be as it was in the days, for example, of the Shamir administration, that everything belongs to us. Nothing belongs to anybody else. The Arab world has nothing to do in the area except to subject itself to Israeli domination and occupation. So long as that doctrine prevailed, even if it was based on certain streams of piety in ancient Jewish thought, nothing could be achieved. But when a secular realism in Israel converged with new currents of pragmatism in the Arab world, impossible things suddenly became possible. And that was the basis of the spectacle which has been celebrated so ardently on so many occasions in Washington and in Cairo and elsewhere across our region. This convergence has created the agreements, the Declaration of Reconciliation of September 1993, the Cairo Agreement, and the other agreements, including the peace treaty with Jordan, Israeli diplomatic relations with Morocco and Tunisia, Israeli commercial contacts of great importance in the oil-bearing Arab states, Qatar and Oman, Kuwait and Bahrain. All of these possibilities flourished in this new atmosphere and created what I will not call the illusion, because I still believe it is going to prevail, created the feasibility of Arab-Israeli peace, which I still think is the dominant theme of Middle Eastern life. But of course the question is whether all of this can survive against the virulent fundamentalist fury and rage shown by the Hamas movement, and whether there is any chance that this can be withstood. First of all, there is an Israeli decision to withstand it. There is no other course. What there is not in Israel, and it is important that everybody here and that all Americans should understand it,